Hi, I'm Bob Massa, and welcome to today's reading of USA Today for Monday, April 15th, 2024. Hello, everybody. Hello, I'm Bob Massa, and we're all set to go. Hi, I'm Bob Massa, and welcome to today's reading of USA Today, which is for Monday, April 15th, 2024. We're going to start with a story that says New York court delves into new territory, a jury selection in hush money, a trial of Trump on Monday, and Asiya Bagchi wrote the story. Barring a last-minute turn of events, a former American president will go on criminal trial for the first time in the nation's history on Monday. Donald Trump is fighting 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. If convicted, the charges could land the presumptive Republican presidential nominee in prison. Many legal experts say a realistic sentence ranges from just probation to as much as 4 years behind bars. It's a case that is sure to divide the country. Republican voters delivered electoral victories for Trump in nearly every Republican primary held this year, despite knowing Trump faces four criminal charges, including the New York charge. Trump has portrayed both Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and trial judge Juan Merchan as biased against him. There are some people who are just going to see this as a political trial. Another one in New York where Trump is certainly not well-liked, Hank Shinecoff, a New York City-based political consultant who worked for former President Bill Clinton, told USA Today. And then there are others who will see this as a way to deal with an illegality that should not have occurred. We're talking about paying off a porno star, Shinecoff said. Jury selection is set to start Monday, just over a year after Bragg announced the indictment against Trump on April 4, 2023. The trial is expected to last between 6 and 8 weeks, according to a media advisor from the court. Here's one we're going to talk about. It says, barges break loose, float uncontrolled down the Ohio River. One of 26 vessels still missing. Bridges are closed. Pittsburgh officials closed two bridges after more than two dozen barges broke loose Friday and floated uncontrolled down the Ohio River, some plunging over local dams. Around 11:30 p.m., city officials responded to 26 barges moving downriver. Three of the barges were empty, and 23 carried cargo such as coal, and one carried fertilizer. Though there was no hazardous materials on board, the Pittsburgh Department of Public Safety and U.S. Coast Guard officials said. One barge containing coal still hasn't been found as of Saturday afternoon. Carol Vernon, a spokesperson for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Pittsburgh District, told USA Today. The Army Corps believes the missing barge sank, but officials can't start looking until river conditions change, she said. The Ohio River near Pittsburgh has experienced flooding in the last day. The most important thing is not necessarily how fast we can recover these barges, but how safely it can be done. There are no reports of any barges colliding with bridges, nor is there known pollution at this time, a U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant J.G. Eboy Mills told the USA Today. Mariners are being advised to steer clear of the area until all barges have been recovered, he said. The navigation channel won't reopen until water levels have lowered, Vernon said. There have been no injuries, but Peggy's Harbor was damaged. City public safety officials closed a rail bridge to Broint Island, about 2 miles west of downtown Pittsburgh. Farther west, the McKees Rocks Bridge was temporarily closed out of caution. Both reopened Saturday morning. Initially, city officials said the West End Bridge had closed, but they clarified it was only the Brunt Island and McKees Rocks Bridges. They may or may not come into contact with substructure, but we are not willing to take the risk, the McKees Rocks Police Department said in a post on Saturday afternoon. The Army Corps of Engineers said in a social media post that it was inspecting facilities for damage and making sure employees and barge crews were safe. Pittsburgh officials said that the barges are owned and operated by the Campbell Transportation Company, located just downstream along the Ohio River from the McKees Rocks Bridge. A call and message to the company was not returned Saturday. From Just Curious, we're going to take this story. It says, you got questions and we got answers, and this one looks pretty good. Eating even a little a bit of mold is unsafe. Oliva Munson wrote the story. Whether it's spoiled milk or expired meat, there might be something inedible lurking in your fridge on some cases. What you thought would be a tasty, it turned moldy. Molds are microscopic fungi that live on plant or animal matter, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Fuzzy strawberries or green spotted bread can indicate that mold has made its way into your kitchen. But what happens if you actually accidentally eat mold? Here's what you need to know, according to a doctor. Past the initial ick factor of consuming mold, not a whole lot happens, says Christine Lee, a gastroenterologist at the Cleveland Clinic. As long as the immune system and the gut system is healthy and intact, and you're not immunocompromised, for that vast majority of people, if they accidentally consume a little bit of mold, really not much happens, she said. The amount of mold someone eats, however, will affect the body's reaction. If someone were to consume a large amount of mold, they might experience nausea, indigestion, cramping, and possibly diarrhea, Lee said. But these symptoms are not inherently a bad thing, she explains. It's your body's protective mechanism kicking in and trying to get rid of the agent out of your body. If you do consume mold accidentally, the best thing to do is to take conservative measures, said Lee. This includes getting rest and hydrating. While most people will not experience adverse reactions, it is unsafe to consume mold. A lot of problems with the mold is that it can harbor other infections or cohabitation, bacterial infections, and those can obviously carry different ramifications, Lee said. This includes listeria. Consuming the bacteria can lead to a listeria infection, which causes fever, chills, nausea, and diarrhea. In the most severe cases, it can be fatal. Eating improperly processed deli meats and unpasteurized milk products are common causes of the type of bacterial infection, according to the Mayo Clinic. And for people who are immunocompromised, including those with gastrointestinal diseases, eating mold could cause further complications. You might be a lot more vulnerable to these agents than under normal circumstances, Lee said. It's just a good idea to avoid it altogether and not put yourself in harm's way or take unnecessary risks. Moving over to money, we're going to start with this one. It says more Americans are claiming parents as dependents on taxes. Many have started doing so in the past 2 years, and Medora Lee wrote this story. Most parents claim their children as dependents on their taxes, but now an increasing number of Americans are claiming their parents, according to a recent survey. More than 54% of Americans ages 25 and older with a living parent said they're claiming their parents on their taxes this year, and 53% of them said they started doing so in the past 2 years, according to a Caring.com survey that last month of more than 4,000 people. Poverty among older adults at least 65 years old has grown faster than any other age group in the past few years as inflation has risen, Census Bureau data shows. That has left many adult children supporting their parents and claiming them as dependents to save potentially thousands of dollars in taxes to help defray the costs. More than 48 million Americans are caregivers, providing $470 billion in unpaid care for their loved ones. That's doing everything from helping prepare meals and paying bills to assisting with medication and medical/nursing tasks to help parents, spouses, and other loved ones live independently in their homes. The average caregiver in the U.S. spent $7,242 in out-of-pocket costs in 2021, according to AARP. Many caregivers also are part of the so-called sandwich generation, simultaneously taking care of their parents and children. Of the 54% of Americans claiming their parents on their taxes this year, 74% have at least one child dependent, Caring.com said. As the baby boomer generation continues to age, we see how stretched thin the sandwich generation truly is, says John Farrell, Caring.com's Director of Financial Planning and Analysis. That's why we have seen a jump in Americans who's also claiming their parents as dependents, the study said. So how to claim a parent as a dependent? First, you got to check eligibility. Check everyone's status. You cannot be claimed as a dependent on anyone's return. If your parent files a joint tax return, you may not be able to claim them as a dependent unless your parent is also filing a joint return to claim a refund for withholdings or estimated taxes paid. Your parent must be a U.S. citizen, U.S. national, U.S. resident alien, or a resident of Canada or Mexico. Check your parents' gross income. Your parents' gross income cannot exceed $4,700 for tax year 2023, $5,050 for 2024, and calculate your support. Your financial support must exceed your parents' income by at least $1 during the tax year. To calculate your support, use the fair market value of your parents' room in your home, the cost of food you could provide, cost of utilities, medical bills, and general living expenses you provide. Does my parents have to live with me? No. In most cases, you only must provide more than 50% of your parents' financial support and meet the other status and income criteria. They can live at another house, a nursing home, senior living facility, or sometimes even in another country. You can claim a parent if they're either a U.S. citizen, U.S. national, U.S. resident, alien, or a resident of Canada or Mexico. Next, we're going to take this one. It says falling EV resale values could hurt sales. Average price for a used one fell up to 32%. The slowdown in electric vehicle sales continues to snowball, with plummeting resale values acting as another roadblock. Over the past year, used EV values have dropped faster than their gasoline-powered components, Car Search Engines, IC Cars said. The average price for a used electric vehicle fell by up to 32%, while the average for a gas model slipped by 3.6%. Tumbling resale values aggravate buyers' worries that an EV isn't worth the price or the potential headaches. They are already worried about EVs' high prices, charging, lack of choice, and driving range. Now they fear when it comes time to sell the vehicle, they're not going to get much back. Consumers didn't used to be worried about the resale value of an EV, but Tesla's chief executive Elon Musk cutting prices made people feel like they owe $50,000 on their Tesla, and now it's only worth $40,000, said Pat Ryan, chief executive of free car shopping app Copilot. When people see the value of an EV drop so dramatically, it creates a problem. Musk aggressively sliced more than 20% off new Tesla prices to try to maintain market share in an increasingly competitive EV market. Those price declines pressured the entire used EV market, but especially his own cars. Four of the most significant price drops in the overall used market between 2023 and 2024 was a Tesla, IC Cars said. Elon's desire to maintain new Tesla sales through price cuts had a very destructive impact on the brand's residual values, said Carl Brummer, IC's chief analyst. Used that Tesla's lost more value than any other brand, and with a 28.9% decline, they lost more than twice as much value as a second-place Alfa Romeo. So what will happen next to EVs? Prices look like they're stabilizing, experts say. So if you're looking to buy one, you may finally be able to get one without spending more than a gas-powered car. The average transaction price at the end of 2023 for a new EV was $50,798, only $2,000 or $40 more than a gas-powered vehicle at $48,759, according to Cox Automotive. In the used EV market, prices hover just below gas cars and could soften slightly in the coming months. The average price for a used EV stood at $30,904 in February, compared with $31,153 for a used gas car, IC Cars said. Used car shoppers with a $31,000 budget have access to the majority of models today, regardless of drivetrain, Bauer said. They can now make that decision based on factors beyond price, such as range and convenience. Range and convenient worries continue to discourage many Americans from buying an EV. Well, we're to sports now. Take a couple of points, major stories here. One says that Caitlin Clark is handling WNBA, a growth opportunity of its existence. Nancy Armour wrote this story. Not since it launched in 1997 has the WNBA faced a more critical season. Women basketball has never been more popular thanks to an NCAA tournament that was so compelling and had so many big games featuring the biggest names that its final for the first time had higher ratings than the men's tournament, not by a small margin either. Caitlin Clark has become a cottage industry like Tiger, LeBron, and Tom Brady, gifting the league a gold mine with her star power, commercial appeal, and a fan base. She's already got rivalries with Diana Taurasi and the Phoenix Mercury, and Sabrina Ionescu, Brianna Stewart, and the New York Liberty, and there'll all be others once Angel Reese and Kamala Cardoso are drafted on Monday night. Sponsors are clamoring for a piece of the W, especially ESPN, and the other media partners are tripping over themselves trying to capitalize on the blockbuster interest generated by the last two college seasons. Handle all this right and the WNBA establishes itself as a true major league sport, maybe not rivaling the NBA, but certainly leapfrogging the NHL. There's just one thing that could derail this freight train of momentum. The WNBA itself. Despite beginning its 28th season, the WNBA still often operates like a startup or a league petrified. It's one step from folding while the NWSL races ahead with expansion. It has added four soccer teams and will add two more in the next 2 years. The WNBA plods along, having announced just one new franchise, which won't begin play until next year. It has tolerated horrendous placements for its playoff games, allowing ABC and ESPN to pit the WNBA finals against the NFL. Ain't no win battle if there ever was one. It's accepted the second-class status from both the NBA, which still owns about half of the W, and some of its owners, who all act as if they've done female athletes some grand favor by giving them a league, and that should be enough. As for marketing, make sure its stars were household names. The WNBA has been, quite frankly, abysmal. The WNBA, I don't think, has done a great job of marketing their individual stars for whatever reason. Because there's been a lot of them, UConn's coach Gino Auriemma said at a Final Four. Aoyama ought to know, given many of the players he's referring to played for him. Even the WNBA commissioner, Kathy Engelhardt, acknowledges the league's poor history of selling its players. The NBA had one marketing position when she took over in 2019, and she said it had never had a CMO until she hired one in December of 2020. Yes, you read that right. A professional league, once supposedly backed by the NBA, still had only one marketing person and no CMO after 20 years of growth. NBA programs will devote entire semesters to this kind of business malpractice one day. Previous WNBA executives will no doubt cite money, or the lack thereof, and the folks who like to hate on women's sports will crow about the WNBA only surviving this long because of the NBA's cash. There is a difference between making money and being profitable, however, and the league is absolutely making money. Bloomberg projected the W would bring in between $180 million and $200 million last season, up from $102 million in 2019. That's not insignificant, especially given how woefully undervalued women's sports have been in terms of media rights and commercial dollars. Just for fun, go back and look at what the NBA's revenues were in the 1970s. And the NBA didn't have to deal with systemic misogyny. But there is no excuse for the WNBA not to thrive now. Not when players like Clark and Reese, and in seasons to come, Paige Bueckers and Juju Watkins are making big names for themselves in the college game and bringing all those eyes with them to the league. Take this story, it said, written by Christine Brennan, by the way. Tiger hopeful despite the Masters. Augusta, Georgia. It was 1:22 p.m. Sunday afternoon, and there was Tiger Woods in his usual red, launching his final tee shot on the 2024 Masters into the lush 18th fairway at Augusta National. He was more than 5 hours too early. The final round leaders weren't even going to tee off for another hour. After shooting an 82, his worst round in his life in a major tournament Saturday, Woods came back Sunday with a 5-over 77 to finish a dead last at 16-over par, all alone in the 60th position. Woods, 48, who barely plays competitively anymore after his 2021 car crash, crushed his right leg, said the biggest challenge for him throughout the weekend was the gusting wind that wreaked havoc on shots throughout the tournament. I think that just the wind and what it was doing out there to the golf shots and the balls and putting, how difficult the course was playing, he said. Doesn't take much to get out of position here. Unfortunately, I got out of position a lot yesterday and a couple of times today. But Woods said all was not lost. It was a good week. It was a good week all around. I think that coming in here, not having played a full tournament in a very long time, it was a good fight on Thursday and Friday. Unfortunately, yesterday it didn't quite turn out the way I wanted it to. Today the round, the way that Tom Kim, who shot 6-under-66, is playing, I thought I had in my system. Unfortunately, I didn't produce it. Woods said he's planning to play in the three remaining men's majors this season, starting with the PGA Championship at Valhalla in May. This is a golf course I knew growing up into, he said of Augusta National. So I'm going to do my homework going forward at Pinehurst, at Valhalla, the PGA Championship, and Troon, the British Open. And that's kind of the game plan. It's always nice coming back here. I know the golf course. I know how to play it. I can kind of simulate shots. Granted, it's never quite the same as getting out here and doing it. Same thing. I heard there's some changes at the next couple of sites, so I've got to get up there early and check them out. After his miserable weekend, there was no use looking back, so Tiger Woods did the only thing he knew how to do, and that was to look ahead. That's it for today's reading of USA Today, and I've been reading from the Monday, April 15th, 2024 issue. If you have any questions about the articles I've read, please call the Chris Listener line at 860-727-9579. And I'm Bob Massa, and so long until the next time.